This video is sponsored by Okara. May 31st, 2006. The founder of the Pirate Bay receives a call waking him up. He rushes out, gets into a cab, but realizes that he's too late. See, this is a plan orchestrated to ruin everything the founder built. And as the founders and their lawyers are taken into custody, they helplessly witness the police raid their 10 data centers. This has been Hollywood's plan for years, and now it's being executed flawlessly. As Hollywood's internal calculations point to billions in lost revenue from piracy, they needed to stop this. The MPAA, their link to Washington DC, was the organization to pull this off. And after years of plotting, lobbying, and diplomatic threats against the Swedish government, eventually the MPAA got the raid they had wanted. They had finally taken the Pirate Bay offline. For the founders, it was now looking like their dream of a free internet might be over. They had started this project not to make money, but to spread an idea. A free internet where media could be shared between everyone, where there was no censorship or authoritarian control, where free speech prevailed.
We need internet freedom. We need some sort of freedom of speech and freedom of information flow. They take over politicians and makes them try to stop the internet because it's bad for democracy or whatever. They wanted to be able to control the way we were doing things.
And as they are hauled into police stations, it looks like it would all come crumbling down, bulldozed by Hollywood lobbyists and compromised officials. Dan Glickman, chairman of the Motion Picture Association of America, seemed to declare victory. Quote, "The actions today taken in Sweden serve as a reminder to pirates all over the world that there are no safe harbors for internet copyright thieves." But then, 3 days later, the Pirate Bay is back online, only this time with a new logo. Hollywood failed catastrophically, making their Pirate Bay problem 10 times worse. The site is now more popular than it's ever been, with thousands of new visitors from the international publicity that the raid generated. Hollywood, the MPAA, and their indebted authorities hadn't even won the first battle. And now they are in for a very long, long war. And today, this story couldn't be more relevant. Corporations have the internet in a chokehold, squeezing free speech in people's wallets as hard as they can. It's forced more and more people onto the high seas, escaping an empty corporate shell of the internet. The walls are closing in on social media as the tech giants tighten their grip. Privacy is long dead as well. Mandatory ID checks were the final nail in the coffin for this. Meanwhile, the big studios have seized the world's film, TV, music, and games in a mad scramble for control. Free speech is being targeted by governments across the West, having to do facial scans to check even tweets in the UK. Saying certain words can get your channel scrubbed from the internet. Reddit is more infiltrated and propagandized than ever before, and the next targets are your phone, your computer, and even the concept of ownership itself. The golden age of the internet just seems to be fading away into the background. But what if I told you it doesn't actually have to be this way? That one man stood up against the powers that be and showed everyone that the people will always have true control over the internet. Well, this is how he's making the internet free from any government or corporation. And how a handful of people have been doing everything they can to save the internet. For Pete Sunday and the other founders of the Pirate Bay, the internet was a golden opportunity. Free discourse and free culture has always been limited by the physical world. To absorb new ideas, you needed them to be printed onto physical books or magazines. To watch films or listen to music, you needed a hard copy of the recording. With the internet, all of those limitations seemed like they could be ancient history. Social problems and issues could be dealt with, society could progress and enter a new golden age, as long as people could find common ground through the exchange of ideas. They saw this beautiful new future as only being possible through internet piracy, an international free exchange of content. Of course, they weren't the first to act on this idea. By the year 2000, internet piracy had gone mainstream. Progression in internet and file-sharing technology meant that semi-legitimized services were beginning to appear, catering to millions of eager customers. Napster's legendary run from 1999 to 2001 was a big red warning sign for pirates in Hollywood. For Hollywood, it was clear that there was massive potential in file-sharing. Clicking download is just a million times more convenient than buying a film or a CD in person. It was the next step in media, but the pirates had gotten there first. Napster grew absolutely massive incredibly quickly, but it was obviously a company and it was based in the US, which made it easy for the music labels to attack on a legal front. Their assault was nasty, brutal, and short. Within months, one of the fastest growing tech companies ever had been stripped for parts in the courts. The studios took tens of millions in assets, as well as payments for damages and even the company name. Other sites sprang up to take Napster's place, like LimeWire or Kazaa, but they nearly always suffered the same fate: sued into bankruptcy. It wasn't until the Pirate Bay came along that Hollywood would face a real challenge to their control. This future public enemy number one for the entertainment industry wasn't who you'd expect. Sean Parker and the people behind Napster had been businessmen through and through. Their clear corporate vision had made it easy for the record labels to deconstruct their operation. Other people in the tech world were halfway in between. Aaron Swartz had worked on the inside as one of the founders of Reddit, and he left early on disgusted with how corporate and soul-sucking the business soon became. In addition to seeing Reddit strangling the freedom that the internet was supposed to provide people, and years of campaigning for a free and open internet had put a target on his back. And then, eventually, after getting threatened with 35 years in prison for downloading academic papers through a guest account at MIT, he tragically took his own life. But that was all in the future. Peter Sunder came from a completely different background to all of them. Along with the other co-founders, Friedrich Nietzsche and Gottfried Svartholm had been involved in a Swedish grassroots piracy collective called the Piracy Bureau. It had been a large group of unique people, all with their own individual political beliefs and reasons for joining. The only thing that united them was their stand against government and corporate control of the internet. The three co-founders of the Pirate Bay were the same. One was a drug addict, another an alcoholic, the third a vegan. They had no real assets, no financial power or business acumen, but they were united by their vision. Unlike Sean Parker or Aaron Swartz, they would never work on the inside. Their beliefs meant they would always be at odds with the establishment. But they shared a vision, an enthusiasm for a certain type of peer-to-peer file sharing which had almost limitless potential. Without one big main server or even an organization like Napster pulling the strings, it was truly decentralized. Unlike their competitors, they weren't going to back down. Their funding came from their own pockets, or from their wealthy backer Carl Lundstrom, who was also in this for ideological reasons. What small amounts of money they did make went straight back to keeping the thing running. At first, it was a tiny operation stemming from a single computer running out of a literal shoebox in Mexico. While they were all technologically literate, Frederick and Gottfried did the majority of work behind the scenes. Peter was more suited for the public-facing work, to be the face of the operation. And it was here that the Pirate Bay would come to shine. At first though, the Pirate Bay seemed like most other file-sharing sites. How could they break them old and gain traction? Well, they did have some key advantages, as instead of having to download and share all the movies, albums, TV shows, games, and other media themselves, the Pirate Bay just gave its users a way to download them from other people instead. If you clicked on one of the links in their archive, it would connect you with whoever was currently sharing that file. In this way, the Pirate Bay itself didn't need to have any copyrighted material on their own servers. All they did was give out a treasure map to anyone else who wants to find it. That was pretty much all that was on their servers, a lot of treasure maps, but no actual illegal treasure. In most countries, this would all still be illegal, and they would happily hold the door open when Hollywood's army of lawyers came knocking. But not Sweden. While the US legal system was taking apart Napster in 2001, the EU was passing its own new copyright laws to deal with these new kinds of companies. Most of Europe was pretty quick to comply, but Sweden dragged their heels. Downloading content was a part of their national identity. It was far more common than in other countries. This was partly because of culture. Sweden heavily regulates alcohol, for example, but also has a long storied history of moonshining in the countryside. They don't take so well to authority, generally. They were one of the only countries during COVID to not lock down everything. And so there were no signs that Sweden was going to give up all of those civil liberties so quickly. Under Swedish law, the Pirate Bay was perfectly legal. It gave them a unique advantage compared to other sites in other parts of the world. Other file-sharing sites were at the mercy of the legal system, but the Pirate Bay refused to step down, and that gave it an advantage, as Peter Sunder would later explain.
It's one of the biggest sites in the world. It still is, and it's growing. And it came out of this need of using a new technology instead of the old file sharing technology. So we wanted to show the new technology called BitTorrent, which I guess all of you kind of know. And it was not really anything from Pirate Bay that was a big innovation. The only thing the Pirate Bay did in order to grow to a large extent was actually not closing down, because everyone else closed down. So we didn't make any technology. We didn't do anything clever. We didn't have good software. We just had everything that everyone else had, except being kind of stupid and having a goal set what we wanted to achieve. And I think that the only thing we did was to not close down, and that was kind of the only goal.
It wasn't the only thing that quickly made them one of the most popular sites on the internet. As they began to gain momentum, the big labels and movie studios began to take notice. They could generally deal with other sites when they got big, as they could intimidate them with legal threats or put pressure on governments and ISPs and shut down their websites. Peter Sunder had a different idea on how to deal with them. Instead of quietly complying with the threats or just ignoring them, the Pirate Bay publicized them along with their own unique response. As you may or may not be aware, Sweden is not a state in the United States of America. Sweden is a country in Northern Europe. Unless you figured it out by now, US law does not apply here. For your information, no Swedish law is being violated. The Pirate Bay co-founder then invites DreamWorks and their lawyers to take out their frustrations in a different way. And DreamWorks and their lawyers were definitely frustrated. The early internet wasn't meant to be clean or controlled. It was open, decentralized, and owned by the people using it. Over time, that changed. A few platforms took over the infrastructure, the data, and the rules. And now we're watching the same thing happen all over again with AI. Most AI tools today are closed systems. You don't know what models they're using, what they're tracking, or how your conversations are being reused. Your inputs quietly become training data, and control shifts away from the user. This is why you should use our video sponsor, Okara. Okara is a privacy-first AI chat platform that gives you access to 30-plus open-source AI models in one place. Unlike most mainstream tools, it doesn't rely on closed models, and it does not train on or sell your data. Your chats are encrypted, and you can switch between different models without losing context. It's built for people who care about privacy, openness, and actually having a choice, not just convenience. We've been here before with the internet, and this time you don't have to make the same mistake. So you can try Okara by using the link in the description below. There was nothing they could do. Their threats boiled down to appeals to US law, bad interpretations of Swedish law, or even more questionable claims about international copyright law, which has never actually existed. Peter made a mockery of them publicly. He knew that they were impotent threats designed to scare off lesser pirates who would back down without knowing their own rights. Of course, the stakes here are massive. If any one of these threats actually landed, the Pirate Bay could go the same way as all the other competitors eventually went. But Peter knew that for now, he could turn it into their advantage instead, using one of their only weapons in their arsenal.
Discussion. And our opponents are basically every project I go into, the opponents happen to be humorless people. So you get this kind of unfair advantage where they look like dicks, and they mostly are dicks as well, but they look like they're what they actually are. And so you get kind of a lot of sympathies for your cause, because you pull down their trousers and see that they're just assholes, right?
Each prank and each viral headline pushed the Pirate Bay further into the spotlight, getting them both fans and enemies. The movie studios, meanwhile, were floundering, and the music labels were beginning to panic. They had killed Napster, and they thought it was that easy. But here was another version of it that they couldn't touch, that was gaining momentum every day, that laughed at their threats and revealed how limited their legal power actually was. If they didn't stop this, they'd be in serious trouble, and soon lose all of their power and control over society. So they needed an answer. Now, remember Dan Glickman? He was the man who celebrated victory at the beginning of our story. Well, this was when he entered the scene. His career was only rising. He had gone from being a lawyer to a US congressman all the way to agriculture secretary during the Clinton years. He could have gone for the big seat, leadership of the Democratic Party. Instead, he took a much more lucrative job, being the connection between the US government and the entertainment industry, the Motion Picture Association of America. As the new head of the MPAA, it was now his job to be the top lobbyist and representative for them in Washington. And the top of his to-do list was end internet privacy, whatever the cost. They were obsessed by it. One of their officials called pirated DVDs the new drug on the streets. And they had much bigger plans than to bust up shady movie salesmen. They were going to go straight to the source and attack online file sharing. And once and for all, take away freedom on the internet. First, the MPAA began to put pressure on the EU. Sweden was still in violation of not following the laws they had passed in 2001. Then they made a direct complaint to the Swedish government in November of 2004. Sweden still didn't budge. Finally, Glickman brought out the big guns, getting the US government to intervene directly. A news report from The Time reads as follows. During the spring, several conversations took place between American and Swedish officials, said Dan Eliasson, Undersecretary Secretary of State in Sweden's Justice Department. During these talks, the American officials said that Sweden could end up on the WTO surveillance list if Swedish authorities didn't effectively combat crimes against copyright laws. They also threatened sanctions if Sweden didn't comply with their lawyers' demands. Finally, the mounting pressure from Hollywood and American elites made Sweden give in, passing new laws in 2005 that specifically targeted the Pirate Bay. Most people and most news sites barely even noticed the change in laws. They thought it would have no influence on regular people at all, and they were kind of right, but they didn't realize that this minor change in the law would completely change the internet forever. Or would it? Peter Sunder and his co-founders knew exactly what was going on, though. Their legal immunity had just been revoked, and they had already begun their preparations for the next phase of their project. Of course, it wasn't going to be easy at all. They had extremely limited options and almost no resources to make use of, and despite what the lawyers for Hollywood would later say, they made pretty much no money from the Pirate Bay. It was barely enough to even keep the servers powered on, and even that had to be subsidized from their day jobs. Now with this new law, their Swedish base of operations was vulnerable. They needed to outsource their servers abroad to have any chance of surviving legal action. It was incredibly hard to find cheap server space, especially for their semi-legal purposes. But it had to work, the whole mission depended on this. And they weren't in it for the money, they were in it to send a message. It was imperative to the future of the internet that they succeeded. Although it's doubtful they really knew just how important their work would be later on in the future. As the co-founders raced to get their backups in place, the MPAA was also making moves and readying their attack. They even began to physically stalk the founders, hiring private investigators to follow them everywhere and take notes of their locations. Some sources say that the Pirate Bay and their co-founders had a man on the inside, who gave them a few hours warning of the incoming raid and enabled them to quickly put their backup plans into action. Peter Sunder, on the other hand, has said on the Futures podcast that the declaration of victory from Glinkman and the MPA came too early, before the raid had even happened.
There was a big raid against the Pirate Bay where they seized over 200 servers that didn't belong to the Pirate Bay. They had no clue what they were doing. They were just doing this because they had to do something drastically really quickly. So
that gave the founders a chance to finalize their backups and get everything in order before anything would actually happen. Regardless, the end result was the same. The raid was a success on paper, but in reality, they had done pretty much nothing to actually stop the Pirate Bay. All those servers they confiscated, most of them weren't even owned by the Pirate Bay. Instead, tons of other Swedish independent websites got taken down instead, hurting really only small businesses. Lots of the policemen also had no idea what they were looking for either, confiscating computer mice and speakers, which obviously did nothing. As for the Pirate Bay going down for just 3 days, even that was mostly for different reasons. The internet traffic that came from the raid was massive. They needed time to deal with it before they went online again to their new, much larger user base. And the important thing for the MPAA, though, was the publicity and the actual arrests. While the legal process would take years, they did eventually secure warrants for all three co-founders. So even if they couldn't shut down the Pirate Bay, they could still make examples of its founders and ruin them financially. It was a massive wave of new problems all at once. The Pirate Bay was more popular than ever, and that brought its own issues of dealing with the increased traffic. But it was hard to see too far into the future anyway. For years, the founders existed in a kind of legal limbo. The case was ongoing, slowly building over time as the MPAA tried to block all of their exits and loopholes. Meanwhile, their infamy meant they were always being watched. The authorities were begging for a reason to detain one or all of them, just like they would with Aaron Schwartz in the US. It felt like the entire world was conspiring against their project. How could it possibly hold up against the pressure? How could they deal with all of the problems? They needed to stay strong as their mission depended on this. While all of this was happening, the raid had already set in motion the next step of the music industry. Two Swedish entrepreneurs had been paying very close attention to what was going on here. They knew that people naturally preferred downloading whatever music they wanted, but didn't like the risk of malware, or the process of torrenting, or the idea that they were even breaking the law to begin with. These two men were Daniel Ek and Martin Lorentzen, and they were going to found a company called Spotify to deal with these problems in a legal way. Of course, they would need a starting point, and they needed music to let people listen to on their platform, but they weren't going to go all out and just buy all the music in the world, even if that's what they wanted to sell to their users. What they did misused this new revolution in media, whilst also disregarding the law as well, as they just pirated it. Spotify's original catalog was almost completely illegal, and their service was too. But unlike their predecessors such as Napster, they had a secret plan. This move got their foot in the door, now they could leverage their growing user base for a place within the industry. And the final step of this plan was to legitimize the monopoly and share it with the record labels. This happened fairly quickly. In 2008, the labels bought a massive share of Spotify for pennies on the dollar. It was a completely obvious deal to undercut the pirates' inconvenience while also cutting the artists out of even more of the profits. Getting the world's music for free and using it in their paid platform meant that Spotify founders could circumvent the rules at first and then offer a great user experience for a low cost. Then later on, they could take back control within the industry. This was all to come. In the court case, meanwhile, the MPAA asked for lengthy jail sentences for all three founders, as well as tens of millions in damages which they themselves had calculated. This was a complete show trial on both sides. The prosecution was pretty open in their desire to set an example and personally punish the co-founders. Meanwhile, the Pirate Bay used it as another opportunity for publicity, arriving at the trial in their own personalized party bus. There were tons of massive problems with the case, however, and it dragged on for years, with some of the charges getting dropped along the way. First, there was the evidence. The hastily written new copyright laws were spotty, and the actual evidence that the Pirate Bay had broken them was even worse, but eventually they forced it all through. It helped that the judge was a former member of Sweden's Copyright Association and their anti-piracy division. Despite the Pirate Bay's complaints, they were found to be unbiased. The appeal has only slightly reduced the sentences by a few months and actually increased the damages they were meant to pay. Of course, during the trial, the website continued to stay online and the co-founders weren't forced to stay in jail. They were free to continue as they always had, and Peter Sundard took the opportunity to push the Pirate Bay to greater and greater heights. It all came from his viral marketing. In one stunt, he approached the owners of a so-called micronation called Sealand off of the southern English coast, offering to buy the nation. He even set up a fundraiser online which quickly gained over $50,000 in donations. There was a reason for the stunt. If the Pirate Bay could claim their own nation, they could write their own copyright laws and be completely safe from further prosecution. And even if this was just a pipe dream, the MPAA still stepped in and convinced the owner to reject their bid. So eventually, Peter Sundar donated the crowdfunded money to a rainforest preservation charity, much to the frustration of his co-founders. And it wasn't their only trick. Another route to a legal safe haven was potentially North Korea. If they could get hosting services there, or even asylum, it would secure the Pirate Bay's future forever. At least, that was the story they told the press. In reality, this was all a hoax, because Peter knew that whenever anyone would ask the North Korean embassy in Sweden anything, they always just said the same thing, no comment. So he announced to the world, mid-trial, that the Pirate Bay would now be hosted through servers on North Korean sovereign territory at their embassy, out of the reach of any other country's legal system. Meanwhile, to really sell it, he set up the Pirate Bay service to spoof a North Korean IP address. Journalists were skeptical at first, but the domain name changes and the technical data confirmed Peter's story. Then they approached the North Korean embassy, which did not deny the claims but just said no comment. So they ate up the story like candy until Peter revealed it was all just a joke a week later. In 2009, the trial finally finished and the guilty verdicts were rendered, along with 1 year sentences and millions in personal damages owed. However, the founders had all but vanished. Ever since they had made their appeals about the biases of the judge, they had known that a guilty verdict was all but guaranteed. If they were given jail time, it might not just be the year they were threatened with. So while in custody, the precedent this trial had set could invite other complaints, other allegations, other sentences. They could easily find themselves taken out of society and away from their loved ones for good, strung along by a long chain of separate jail sentences. It meant that they had to do the unthinkable and leave it all behind. Frederick and Godfred dodged the border guards and fled the country, eventually settling in Southeast Asia. It was heartbreaking, but they had to build new lives. People knew very little about their whereabouts, but they were sometimes spotted at net cafes in Cambodia or Laos, with just a simple laptop in hand. It would be years before they were finally arrested. In the meantime, the record labels had a different plan to beat piracy. With Spotify, they had solved the true problem of convenience. Most people would happily pay the fee to avoid feeling like a criminal or going through the process of torrenting. Movies and TV would eventually go the same way with Netflix and other platforms. platforms, following the same streaming platform business model that Spotify had created. Despite this true victory against the pirates, though, they still wanted to punish them for even temporarily breaking the status quo. For the Pirate Bay co-founders, it meant that the hunt would never end. Warrants went out and the co-founders were now fugitives. Peter, however, wasn't going to flee to Southeast Asia like his co-founders. He had one last trick up his sleeve. If Peter could secure a seat in the European Parliament, he would gain legal immunity and not have to serve his jail sentence or even pay the damages. A Finnish national, Peter ran on the platform of internet freedom and liberty for the Pirate Party. It wasn't as much of a stab in the dark as his other stunts either. They had previously gained seats in the European Parliament off the back of the publicity for the raid and the trial in 2009, but it wasn't meant to be. After a loss of the polls and with no options left, Peter was finally arrested in 2014, 8 long years after the raid, which had started it all, and 2 years after he was called in to serve his sentence. This whole worldwide search they had undertaken had just been a huge waste of time, as Peter was finally spotted at a farm in southern Sweden rather than across the world. He had no choice but to serve his time. In a year, he was then out again and straight back to campaigning for internet freedom. Godfred had been arrested a couple of years earlier in Cambodia, and was extradited to Europe, where he eventually served 3 years, some of which in solitary confinement. Frederick was arrested around the same time on the Lao-Thailand border, where he served just under a year before being released. As for the damages, they never really got anything of value. Despite their claims, the Pirate Bay hadn't enriched its co-founders, so they couldn't get blood from a stone. Hollywood didn't even care at this point anyway. Streaming services had given them everything they wanted, and now they could focus on squeezing the showbiz industry itself for everything it had. Since this corporate takeover of streaming, artists' pay had stagnated or even fallen compared to before. Morally bankrupt technocrats have enriched themselves off of their middlemen platforms, investing that money into military AI and anything else they think will make money. Every time you stream a song on Spotify, you contribute to Daniel Ek's personal investment fund and its shady funding of dangerous technologies. Every time you watch something on Amazon Prime, it contributes to Bezos' yacht fund and his ever-growing control of journalism and the mass media. Hollywood has kept up the pressure on pirates, of course, but in a nonsensical, predatory way. Instead of tackling the actual problems of convenience, they continue to target people, seemingly at random, and drag them through hell in courts. In 2008, they arrested a man called Robert L. Henderson for recording The Dark Knight in a movie theater. After a disproportionate show trial, they gave him 2 years and a massive fine for copyright infringement. There are countless cases like this all across the world. Even today, it's still going on. In India, they routinely haul people in for owning pirated DVDs. One trial lasted 10 years, only for the case to get thrown out due to a clear lack of evidence. But it doesn't matter. The financial damage of dealing with these court cases is the real punishment. NBC Universal is currently doing everything they can to expose the person who leaked the audio track of Minions 3 before it was released, sending DMCAs to Google and Reddit where the leaks took place. If you get on their radar, they'll make you pay however silly the crime was. But one thing was that the film and TV industries were never able to get the same monopoly that Spotify did. They're now splintered across dozens of separate streaming platforms. Watching any movie or series you want has gone from the cost of one cheap subscription to tens of expensive ones. It isn't convenient or cheap to watch that content legally anymore. Instead, it's all playing right back into the hands of pirates once again. As Spotify increases subscription costs, alienates artists as well, they're slowly starting to lose their hold on the market. And Peter Sunder and his co-founders may not be involved today, they may not have won their own court case or their appeals against a corrupt system, but they did seemingly offer the world a solution. The Pirate Bay and sites like it will never truly die. The system they created is pretty much impenetrable. It's like a crocodile, an organism perfectly adapted to its function, remaining pretty much unchanged across time. Crocodiles have outlasted the dinosaurs, and they'll probably outlast us too. The Pirate Bay outlasted all of its old competitors, and it'll probably outlast Spotify too. As long as the co-founder's vision for a free internet stays alive, there will always be people willing to keep it running. As we've mentioned in this video before, piracy is rising once again as streaming collapses. It's pretty much impossible to completely stamp it out. As today, it's mirrored over thousands of proxy sites, there are many moles to whack. And in 2012, the Pirate Bay switched to MagnetLink, so anyone with a file to share could generate their link. The change also cut down the size of the directory by a lot. Today, the Pirate Bay's core files are all so small and easy to replicate, it's pretty much impossible to wipe out. Which means, thanks to the Pirate Bay, there seemingly will always be a release file for the greed of the studios and record labels. The harder they squeeze consumers, the worse they make their services, and the more people will resort to sailing the high seas. But the recent rise in piracy is no coincidence. It isn't just about this. As this underground layer to the internet, internet may well become the final refuge for free thinkers. In the UK and soon in other Western countries, controversial sites and opinions are getting blocked behind ID scans. Facial recognition is now everywhere. Mass surveillance has become the norm. Countries like Australia are banning social media for many. Without sites like the Pirate Bay trying to make the internet free, we would have a corporatized, governed internet. And if you thought it was bad with censorship now, can you imagine what else it could have been like? A Chinese-style firewall. So if you ever get sick of corporate greed and government oversight, remember, there might be an alternative. And of course, we're not condoning this, but it is clear thanks to one man and his dream for a free internet, we are here today able to discuss these kinds of things.